Thank you very much. Thank you so much. And let me reintroduce our producers. We've got Dan Janvey, producer, Michael Gottwald, producer, John Williams, class of 06, associate producer, and Matt Parker, co-producer. And we have a little visual interest over here. They were saying, well, you're going to play the whole credits. And I said, well, yes, our students always watch all the credits. Plus, if you're going to get your first credit, it might be office intern, so you want to see it. So thanks. I know we've got lots of questions from the audience. I just want to ask sort of one to start. There's such an incredible sense of place in the movie. And as producers, you had to kind of realize the creative vision of director Ben Zeitlin and make it happen with what you had. And I just wondered if you could talk about like one of the more spectacular things that you had to do to make this, the flood or the hurricane or something like that, just to start off the...
Sure.
There we go. Should I?
Yeah.
Matt, do you want to start?
Go ahead.
Dan. Okay, Matt. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome, Dan.
It's a good question. Thank you. I think the biggest, from a locations perspective, one of the biggest challenges of mounting the film was how we were going to flood the town. And the way that, like, that's normally an extremely expensive thing to do. And if you're doing it in a bigger film, I guess you'd build a set on a stage that you then flood. Mm-hmm. Or you would do it using visual effects and CGI. And so one of the ways we went about doing that is, if you notice in the beginning of the movie, every house in the bathtub is on stilts. It's up in the air. And that's actually true of the area that we shot the film in Terrebonne Parish, Louisiana, where the farther down south you get, the higher the houses get to avoid flooding because they're in flood zones. And so because of that thing that the houses are 9 to 13 feet up in the air, that we then went and recreated the bathtub in a swamp. And so let's say you have
Bob.
should we maybe not do this slide? Because this is better than our... Well, we'll leave it on this. This is our assistant prop master, Bob.
Oh, that's
Bob. That's the beginning of the school boat.
We just have a show and tell right here.
That's the burnt out truck that we... Oh,
there's...
Wait, can you pause? Okay.
It's probably one of the first times people have seen the truck that became the Turk.
Yeah. So we brought in a guy from Providence, Rhode Island, which I hope doesn't go under in snowpocalypse. John's in medical school in Providence after graduating from Swarthmore and working on Beasts of the Southern Wild. Okay, but so if you basically have a stop, let's say you have a stop sign and it's 5 feet off the ground. If you then put that stop sign in water, just sticking out of water, it'll look like the water rose up. And so we rebuilt a bunch of our sets in a swamp. And then in the end, everything got destroyed. But that was one of the key things, is we found a swamp that had all these busted houses with water up to their porches. And we said, this sells the effect. So we just literally rebuilt their house in the middle of water to make it look like the water rose up.
And well, there are actually three stages. One, there's the bathtub as you see it in the beginning. Then there's the flooded version of the bathtub. And then there's the kind of after the levee is blown up, it's all dried out and dead and everything. And those are all three separate locations that, as Dan was saying, we put like physical markers to portray that it is the same place.
It was also in that, too, we were really keeping an eye on the water levels. We had to
pull up a couple shoots. I think, you know, the first day we had to pull up a week because where they're kind of like boating around the dam, the water was about to, or they were about to release, open the dam and let all the water out. So we couldn't have even had a boat in there. So we pulled the shoot up a week to achieve that. And then to go up to Honey Island, where Dan was just talking, where there's the houses that are kind of built like right on the water. The water level was going up and down. So I think we had to pull that up a day or so too. So it was really like timing and, you know, a lot of other things to get that look right and to really sell it in the movie.
There were a lot of different things in the movie that we had to keep track of the weather and water levels for, which is a really bizarre way to live your life. Like, we had someone on the crew who would look at water levels in like Minnesota to know in like a week what the water levels will be like in Louisiana on the Mississippi River.
And especially like, you know, it's like Army Corps of Engineer information. And to a bunch of us who've never done anything like that, I remember like several arguments, like, you know, like, wait, it's the information is saying this or it's saying this. Should we go shoot this tomorrow or a week from, you know? And luckily we got it right.
And that was with a BP oil spill on top of it, which was physically encroaching on our shot locations as we were making it.
And it felt like the world was, like, it's a movie about the end of the world. And it's like the movie's inspired by, it's actually not a New Orleans film, which is a little bit of a misconception. It's inspired by mostly by the coastal communities of the bayou communities of coastal Louisiana. And specifically, it's a part of the country where coastal erosion is making communities disappear very rapidly. And there's a football field of land that's just disappearing into the Gulf. Every, I think it's hour or day. And so we wanted to make a movie that sort of dramatized this sense of what happens when your home is literally disappearing. And then it's largely a fishing community, and the BP oil spill just added this extra layer to what we were doing, because it literally felt like southern Louisiana and the Gulf of Mexico was just going to be destroyed. And it was a logistical nightmare on top of that.
Actually, the irony of the BP oil spill was that, which occurred on day one of our shoot, was that for a while there, yeah, no joke, actually, was that for a while there, they employed a lot of the people in the area to go out with their boats. If you owned a boat, you stood to make a lot of money and go out and help the cleanup efforts. So for a while there, this chief location that we had was turned into something out of like E.T. It was like a center for basically the operation to go out and clean up BP as well as the people working with them. But then after BP left, that flow of money just wasn't there, but there also wasn't any shrimp or crawfish or crab that you could go out and farm. So for a while there, it was very, very dire straits for the community. This was all after we had gotten...
And BP also commandeered a helicopter we had booked for the evacuation scene. I think was Wink going to go up in the helicopter or Nazy?
No, they were supposed to be... After my starring scene, you mean, when I'm pinning them down? And Jay will... Yeah.
When Wink is sick, if you see a big, bushy, blonde-haired fellow, that's Dan. So Dan is... in addition to producing the film, is killing the leading man in the film. So, way to go, Dan.
Thank you. But, no, the helicopter... Yeah, it was one of the few things we couldn't get, actually.
We had it planned, we had it booked, and BP, like, paid them more, and they took our helicopter.
It's not just that they paid them more. We learned a lot about like the BP rescue, the cleanup operation. It was massive, mm-hmm. And it's like the way BP worked, which we're sort of conflicted because I guess it's good that they had to clean up their own mess to some extent, but like they booked every single helicopter for 24 hours a day for months at a time.
And employed every person down there. It was kind of like buying their soul back, in a sense, you know?
Yeah.
True.
But
question?
We should make this as open a conversation as possible. So
so we're going to bring a mic around.
Or you can just yell.
Or you can yell.
Yeah.
Question for the audience.
In the back. Yes. Oh, in the, yes.
Sure. Ben, who's the director, has been living in Louisiana since August of 2006. And, you know, he's always had an affinity for the area, and we made a short film down there with him in 2007, and he's basically been living there since. And, you know, it's very much a part of Ben's, it's a center of his creative process that he wants to tell stories with Louisianans about Louisiana, because it's a, if you've been down there, you know, it's a fascinating place, and it's a place that has its own philosophy and sort of feels like it's almost totally separate from the country. I mean, it feels like a totally different world. And that's always not only fascinated Ben, but fascinated us too. And it's since college, it's the closest thing that I've had to home too. And I think as far as like, you know, Ben is interested in telling, you know, stories that resonate with like universally. And I think finding the kind of folklore and in the specifics of a place. So although the bathtub is not an actual place, it's inspired by like the communities that Dan was talking about down there that actually are cut off by levees and actually have been receding, or the water has been rising for years and years and years, and what started as like, you know, 800 families is now down to 50. All of that is very much happening, and I think what Ben wanted to do is take that predicament, that kind of like environmental predicament, but also find some universal, you know, themes and story elements in there and create his own place by distilling all the things in South Louisiana, all the disparate cultural elements, which are very disparate. You know, there's a lot of different cultures going on in South Louisiana, putting them in one place. Yeah, to answer your question, I mean, also additionally, there was just an exhaustive rehearsal process with the actors, to the point where if something didn't feel right coming out of, one of their mouths, like if they didn't feel comfortable saying something, you know, or a word didn't quite feel, they said, like, you know, I think I would actually say something more like this, then they would, Ben would rewrite the script with them in that scene. And so it was an intense amount of collaboration. Not only, you know, we had a lot of crew from New Orleans, we had a lot of crew from the area, and we also, there was a, you know, intimate collaboration between Ben and the actors too, which are all from, they're all from South Louisiana. And they're very different from their parts, obviously, but, you know, they collaborated with Ben to kind of hammer out the story and the script. Can we call on people? Is that a,
yeah, go for it.
Sure. I mean, we can't speak to the actual directing her, because that's Ben's thing. But I think that it was actually way more of a traditional process. Or if Ben was here, he would say it's more of a traditional process with her. Actually, that she, although she was only six when we shot, he would sort of, it was a traditional process for an actress in that he would tell her what was going on in a scene. You know, she would learn her lines. You know, he would say, and you have to remember that this has just happened, so this and that. And she would basically be like, I got it, I got it, I got it. And then she would just go into a scene and just, like, transform. And then when the camera calls cut, she gets out of it. I mean, she just, it's just like, she has a natural, I don't know, something inside of her that allows her to do that.
J-Will, what are some memories you have of young Quvenzhané?
Well, so I was like, I had maybe the most boring position on the film to recount to other people, but Nisi, I think I can contribute a little bit to who Nisi is. I mean, she is just like an exceptional human being. I think it's sort of palpable being in the same room as her. She would come. I would be basically in a gas station office from like, you know, 14, 16 hours a day, trying to figure out how we were supposed to do the insane things that we were supposed to do with the no money that we had. And so I would be really fatigued just like sitting there stressing, like my hair would be going everywhere. And they would be shooting inside of like essentially like, you know, an airtight box in southern Louisiana in June or May for like, well, maybe I shouldn't say the actual hours. I don't know how long a child's allowed to work legally.
She worked for 24 hours a day.
Yeah, the adults would be working inside of the hot box for 14 hours, and she would come into the office at 10 p.m. Just like wanting to play, you know? She's just like not done. She was just like, she was unstoppable. She's just a force. And the other, I learned very quickly, you couldn't, I would go crazy and start cursing or whatever. And if I had any sense that Nazi was around, I would have to shut it down because she would remember like verbatim how you messed up. You know what I mean? Like she retains information better than most human beings do, and emotes as well. She's just like, she's the real deal. And
you know, she comes from a really wonderful family too. She has great parents and who keep her, you know, focused on being a kid most of the time too.
Her mom was my like favorite colleague. I sat next to her at Sundance. She's just, yeah.
And when her dad would come to set, he would like fish. You know, he'd find a place to go fish.
But she's actually very much not like her character at all. She hates to get dirty.
True
fact. And as she would say, a big difference is that she wears pants.
You know, John was being modest about not being in an exciting position. There was one story.
Do we want to recount that now?
Yeah, do you want to tell it?
Dan, I think you should recount it.
Parker, you start. The highlight of our whole time in the bayou.
Well, you know, so we had to get porta potties. There weren't many.
Let's first establish what John's position was, like what he was doing day to day, so we know what this means.
Have you guys heard of laptops?
Dan, describe what he was doing.
I mean, well, the truth is that John had an extremely important job.
I was the accountant. Let's not beat around the bush. Yeah.
But the cool thing about being the accountant, I mean, other than the fact that it's not cool, is every single... Like, in many ways, I've always thought that you could tell the weirdest story about the making of the movie, because every single dollar that was spent passed through you. And, like, so you sort of know this, like, the insane forensics of the movie. And I do think, like, the amount of weird stuff that you saw, you know, like people buying, like, bird seeds and, like... vendors, and I don't even know. But also, he sat inside a lot, I guess, is the not fun part.
He also, in a sense, became like a therapist, because, you know, when he's dealing with money, everybody wants to talk to you about their life, and, you know, and so John was, you know, very good to a lot of people in that sense. But
you did become like the group's like comfort.
But there are probably other questions, so we should probably... Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But it also made you go crazy.
Yeah,
like
crazy.
We pushed you to the brink of sanity.
Anyway, I rescued a porta potty at one point, and that's the story.
Okay. We had this. This is actually a good making of story. There was this one central. So in the end of the film, when they're walking on the road, that's the road. What's it called? It's called the Causeway, mm-hmm. And it's the Causeway to Ile de Jean Charles, which is a central influence on the film. And it really is this road with water on both sides of it. And so we were shooting the hero shot of the film. And wherever you go on a movie, big or small, you have to have bathrooms. And so we had a porta potty left on the side of the road. And usually you sort of bring it in the morning and bring it out at night or the next day. And a storm hit and the porta potty got carried out into the water. And it was after a couple of days of being used, so it was just filled with poop. And... we had to, it's like when you're in communities that aren't your own, you really have to sort of not let stuff like that happen. And so John heroically swam out to the porta potty.
Tied to a truck with a rope around his
Indiana
body.
Indiana Jones type stuff. Yeah. And he lassoed the porta potty and literally pulled it to shore, just swimming in fecal matter. All our Oscar nominations sit on your shoulders.
Yeah, it's thrilling doing the accounting and swimming in poop.
Similar.
Here in the front.
So I guess this is more of like a sophomore focused question.
Yeah.
We're ready. Michael and I are ready for this one.
How did your background at sophomore prepare you to
nice.
Out the other
nice.
I think every day, every...
Was the swim test a part of that?
Absolutely. I just want to thank the administration. No, at Swarthmore, you had to be prepared to get weird every single day. And that's what I did in the Bayou. I had no background in accounting, and I was prepared to get weird and figure out how that worked. So I did, and, you know, one day it was accounting, and the next day it was a porta potty. And I think absolutely Swarthmore prepared me for that.
Well, we did sort of, like, one of the reasons we hired you for the job was sort of because of Swarthmore. Like, oh, he must be a smart guy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
he can
yeah.
probably add and subtract.
We were just talking in the office, and they were like, yeah, it was because, you know, it was like you had encountered finance before, and you were, like, a science major. And I was just like, I studied film and media studies and minored in German. but, the, yeah, this definitely had the – I had a bunch of friends who had graduated from here that they knew who were really good at science. They mistook me if I wanted to.
There was, like, this weird science. Perception that, like, John would be very good at doing homework.
Oh, I had recently taken the GREs. I think that did it, too.
We don't even know what that is.
Yeah, it helps.
To answer your question, the swim test helped. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Keep them coming.
Keep it, yeah.
I saw that the play was inspired by the play. The movie was inspired by a play. Can you talk a little bit about how that, you know, the play factors into the movie?
Dan, this is you.
Matt, I feel like you should take
no.
this one. The play, it's a great question. The play is called Juicy and Delicious. It's a long, complicated answer. I think in short, the play is about a young boy named Hush Puppy with a dad, Wink, who's dying.
10 years old.
Yeah, 10-year-old boy in this mythic southern landscape. And the end of the world is crashing down on Wink and Hush Puppy, and Wink's teaching Hush Puppy how to survive the southern apocalypse. So I think you see the very, like, that's all in the movie. And then what we did is we took that story and then took the story of what's happening in these towns in southern Louisiana that are threatened and disappearing. And we wanted to make a movie that used both ingredients to tell each other, if that makes sense. Doesn't really, does it? But, that's okay.
I feel like the idiom of the film is
like the language,
yeah,
the way they
like,
talk.
Well, yeah. The dialect, too large. I mean, there, it definitely borrows pretty heavily from the play.
Well, sort not of, yeah. not dialect, but like certain phrases and certain sayings that Wink has are definitely borrowed from the play. It's sort of like comically. Well, it's not so comic in the film, but in the play, it's much more comic. The like relationship between them and how he kind of always refers to her as if she was a.
Well,
male.
It's he in the play.
Right, it's he, right. Okay, fair enough. But, you know what I'm saying.
The truth is that the play really, like, the adaptation of the play really came to life when we found these places in southern Louisiana, and we felt like these communities somehow tell the story of a parent dying and a child preparing for that. So, yeah, something to think about as your Friday night. Gets wild.
And Dan did help develop, well, I think, and Michael did too,
yeah.
And like what this is in the early days before it got to be a real production. These are true creative producers. So if anybody's interested in film, there you can do the like suit type thing, but also have a heavy hand in the creative process, for the record.
Could you talk a bit about how the Oraks were created?
Very
little money.
Thanks. So the aurochs, the starting place for how, like, the whole idea of the aurochs is you never really know if they're real or from Hush Puppy or if Hush Puppy's imagining them. And I would say that that's true a lot of the film. And one of the central aesthetic mechanisms of the movie is that this is really coming from her point of view and her imagination. And so when we went about conceiving how we were going to do the aurochs, the starting place discussion was, how would Hush Puppy see these things? And so immediately it did not make sense to us to have them be CGI or VFX. And so they had to be real, because to Hush Puppy, they would be absolutely real. And we looked to older movies before the days of CG. And we specifically looked at a movie like Willow, which does this type of thing. And we looked at a lot of miniature trick photography. And so what we figured out is that we raised these baby Vietnamese potbelly pigs from birth. And we actually had like a pig mother horse, like pig whisperer person train them. And we figured out a way to dress them in fur costumes and how to get them comfortable. And then we taught them a series of tricks. So however
popcorn was key.
Yeah, however many shots there are in the film of the aurochs corresponds to something that we taught them how to do. So in the end, like the finale shot is the aurochs bowing down to Hush Puppy. That was one of the things they were able to do. It usually involved food. And it was combined with like trick photography where the pigs were about this long and this tall, so they were tiny. And so we built tiny sets to make them look huge.
And the whole thing taught them how to run on treadmills as well.
Yeah, the whole thing. So it was all of this was timed perfectly. So we had what, like a 6 week shoot,
seven and a half weeks.
So it was timed that the little piglets would be the right size. So that was going on in New Orleans while we were in the bayou. We'd rented a firehouse. And by the time we got finished with the principal photography, the whole crew moved up and then shot the pigs at
it was
the
surreal.
Right age.
Yeah. It was absolutely surreal. The only exception to the CG VFX thing is obviously the confrontation at the end. The way every other Auroch shot is shot in camera on 60mm film. And those shots were the only things that were green screened in the film.
With digital.
Yeah, with everything else is a practical shot. And we love that type of cinema. Like, it actually, from a story point of view, doesn't throw you out of Hush Puppy's world, because there's no technology in the bathtub. It's like, there's no computers, there's no iPhones. The most technology you'll see is like an engine on a boat. So it sort of fits the whole universe of the film that these things are going to be real. Yeah, I love those little things.
Yeah, this is Jay Will. This is Jay Will pig.
I think the pig's name, what other pig's names? There was Bo Biden.
There was
Hannah Montana, Mona, and Jay Will.
Ohio?
Ohio.
Well, no, the Ohio pig was killed.
Well, one of the Ohio pigs was killed.
Yeah.
Not by us, please. Calm down.
I think it had pig leukemia.
No, I think really, actually.
It got shot.
Yeah, no, like a neighbor shot and killed it in Ohio.
We don't know how Ohio works. We're only here to defend Louisiana.
No, but and also the pig that you see actually in the film, that was the first pig that we ever had. And we got it so early in development to kind of like run test footage with it that by the time we shot, it was that big.
They start cute. They don't end cute.
Yeah. And now there was a point, I think, after production where the pig got so big that it couldn't really move. And Ben's sister had to put it on a diet so that it would actually get, you know, less fat enough so that it could actually walk.
I picked up that pig from its birth farm, and it shat all over the vehicle.
Thanks, Dan.
One of the
less lesson? That, what lesson can we derive from that?
We were constantly battling feces on this shoot. wait, did you mention Ray? Did you talk about Ray?
Oh,
Ray?
Ray kind of designed the whole.
Yeah, we had.
Oh, that means nothing to them.
But it's interesting. I mean, that Ray Tintori, this guy that kind of designed the whole practical visual effects and the pig thing and all that, is a friend of theirs from Wesleyan who also directed a lot of videos for MGMT and things like that. Not that anybody.
Well, the most important thing is Ray came to Swarthmore to show his short films.
Yeah, here's another. So when we brought Ben in, when this building was new, I think that was actually 2005. There used to be a film society, and I used to run the film society, and we would bring them in as guest speakers and pay them a speaker's fee that they would then use to make their next short films. And they would just show short films and sort of like curate little programs. And so we brought Ben Zeitlin in here in 2005 to show Egg, and then the next year we brought in Ray Tintori, who was our second unit director, who I think is now working on his first feature, hopefully. So you're in like the hallowed hall of Wesleyan.
They still talk about it.
I think
they made like $200 and they thought it was the greatest.
Yeah. So technically you're all an executive investor in this, producers.
Yeah, in the Beast of the Southern
Rock. Short films. Over here.
Could you talk a little bit about the role of realism in the film? It certainly has a lot of whimsy and a lot of subjectivity. You talked about how we're seeing things through the eyes of Hush Puppy, but for all of that, it also felt very gritty to me, very dirty. It has almost a documentary style to it at times. And so it's a little surreal seeing that, the film, and then hearing, you know, having the curtain pulled back and hearing about how you would create a flood or create a storm or composite pigs. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what role you wanted realism to have in the film, and maybe kind of the techniques and
what experience. I think that the way you speak about it is very much in line with how we conceived of it. I think you get this fundamental premise of what we're trying to do, but to add on to it a little bit, the style of the film was always meant to be absolute realism. And so a lot of people mistakenly refer to that this is a piece of magical realism, and we think that it's like the farthest thing from that. And one of the techniques, one of the main cinematic influences on the film is a documentary filmmaker named Les Blank. And there's a thematic overlap with Les Blank too in terms of the films that he made about Cajun culture in Louisiana, which are pretty masterful. I recommend everyone check them out. And so we at all times wanted the camera to address what it was shooting as if it was as real as possible. And it's an aesthetic that I think you see more in documentary film than fiction film, although it does also borrow from like fictional legacies like the Dardenne brothers. And it was also, as we were striving for this realism, it was also to be as much from her perspective as possible. So if you go back and watch the film again, try and pay attention to the height of the camera. And I think you'll notice that it's very, very unusual because the camera is all shot at Hush Puppy height. And so as the camera explores the world around it, it's doing it from her literal eye line. And most cameras are actually shot from an adult's, like the camera itself is from an adult's point of view. And the way we technically achieved that is that the cinematographer wore a rig, it's called an easy rig, where the camera would be hanging off of a pole so that he can maneuver it at a very low height.
And also that there was a choice by Ben to light every set 360 degrees because with the non-professional actors that we had, he wanted to make sure that they could, you know, play and improvise as much as possible. And I think that the kind of exploratory camera goes hand in hand with that sort of playful feel. So the camera can wander wherever it wants to, and it will still, everything will still be lit.
And also just in basic, on a basic level, you also have to then build sets that you can go anywhere, which is somewhat unusual as well. I hope that answers, does that answer your question?
Yeah,
I feel like it's a good enough question that you'll think of it. No, I'm serious. I think it's a really strong question, but I think it's complicated. Like there are all these thematic things we can talk about. Like, I think your question really also speaks to the scene where they go to the floating stripper shack to see the mother, and I think it's for you to decide what that is, because it's. Yeah, it's dreamlike. Yeah, it is certainly a departure.
And also, in case you're asking, there is no floating stripper shack, if that's what you mean by realism. I just because that, I think that question is posed a lot, how much does it represent the Bayou community? And I think, you know, you have to just draw some lines.
Yeah, it's not. That's a good point. It's not at all. The Southern Louisiana does not look like this in any way.
Well, that's not true. What do you mean? In the whole film? The whole film doesn't?
No, I'm saying that it's drawn on the reality, but it's a complete abstraction of it.
Right, sure.
Like, yeah, for example, you have houses on stilts, but they're not like weird shacks on top of school buses.
Right.
Yeah, I feel like our production designer added, you know, extra bits to the existing thing and kind of altered or heightened the existing reality that was there. In a way that it's not very noticeable. So a lot of people do confuse it with, like, reality and actually the way things look in the bayou.
Just a question about 60 millimeter. Is it difficult working with 60 millimeter nowadays? How soon did you get to see what you shot? Did you have video taps, anything like that? Was it all just kind of handheld? Using hand cranks?
We shot on an Arri camera. That we got out of New York, and every day our film would travel from the bayou to New Orleans to the airport, then fly to Seattle because we were on a budget, but we had a grant through the Sundance Institute at this lab in Seattle that would process the film called Alpha City. So that would be the next day. Then they would process it. Then it would come back. So it was like a 2 or 3 day.
It can be up to. It could have been up to 5 days.
Could have been up to 5 day turnaround, and it was right at the point. It was the summer or spring, summer of 2010, before like digital dailies and things like that, where they're posting it online. So it was taking a minute to get back. But we had a really excellent camera department. We didn't lose a single frame of film in that whole process, and it's pretty outstanding considering like half the time they were like on water, you know, like unspooling the film and transferring it. So
there's so many. Also, to speak to the question of the choice of shooting on film, film's a tried and tested medium. Like, and we were in some of the most extreme physical conditions that you can shoot a movie in terms of heat and water. And we know that film works in those environments. Film also has an incredible latitude in terms of what you can expose it to. So you actually can shoot a wider range of things on film than digital. And also it has a quality that film can't replicate from an aesthetic point of view. And I really, really want to encourage people to think about shooting on film. It can be a more expensive choice, but I think it leads to a very different type of film and filmmaking. And if you look at this year's Best Picture nominees, 6 of the 9 films are shot on film. And so everyone is saying film's dying. But it to me, it actually still has a vitality that digital film hasn't replaced. And I would encourage you to think about what your story is. Like, you don't shoot Lincoln on the red. It's Abraham Lincoln. And likewise, Zero Dark Thirty was shot digitally, and to me that makes complete sense. It's like that is a story as much of our times as anything else. And so for us, what I'm trying to say is the bathtub is made up of these real, everything's real in the bathtub. Everything's built and scrappy. And so we thought that the 60-millimeter aesthetic fit that well.
Interesting sidebar. The cinematographer, we were interviewing a bunch of different people, and we'd flown people down and all this stuff, and the cinematographer was actually a friend of everybody's that was down kind of visiting, and he picked up a, like, prosumer, you know, a video camera,
and followed one of the piglets around the yard. And it wasn't even, he was kind of trying to get the job, but he put the tape of that where Ben Zeitlin could see it. Ben found it, and when he saw it, he was like, this is the guy. So he won the job on video, but ended up shooting on film.
It's probably a tribute to the street in New Orleans, which is obviously a tribute to the Elysian Fields of Greek mythology. So I think it's hitting two stones with one rock, or
sure.
What is it?
two stones with one rock. That's
two
right.
stones yeah. with no, one rock.
It's correct. Weird because it's like a New Orleans reference, but it's also a beyond New Orleans reference. It's
The New Orleans reference is to the
street, right?
No, is
no, that's a self.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying.
To the mythology. Yeah. Anyway,
we went to Wesleyan. Not
But that actual location during shooting, we were sharing with the Green Lantern.
If you look at the trailer for Green Lantern, you can see the same that same weird ship thing in it.
And they were in there like 1 week. We were there the next week.
Yeah.
Do we want to move? Go right a little.
Sure. Let's go right. Far right. Jay, well, did you work on any short film?
Yeah, we had a little dinner thing, and I was talking about this a bit, but I didn't quite finish. I worked on a couple here, and we just sort of goofed around a bit, and then I tried to make the first film that I tried to direct was supposed to be my senior thesis, and I had never really written or directed one, and I was also trying to produce it, and my like buddy starred in it, and anyway, it was awful. I destroyed all copies. I think he might do you have one?
We have one. I might have to dig through the box.
Okay, well don't
stick around.
You can start that process now. We'd love to see it. Yeah.
It was just awful, but I mean it, when you don't know what you're doing, it's gonna be bad. My suggestion is make a stinker early, because you learn. Like now, I know a bunch of stuff. If I were to make another one, I feel like I mean, it would probably also be maybe even less than mediocre, but far better than the first one I made. So that's just one thing I want to say. Especially here, I think Swarthmore is such an intelligent and critical community that a lot of people creatively are afraid to put their work out in front of that critical eye because people are so sharp here. But you have to start somewhere. Like the first time you tried to write letters, it's just miserable. Like your handwriting was terrible when you're a little kid. You know what I mean? It takes practice. You have to fail a bit. Like it's just everything.
Ira Glass has the most incredible take on exactly what you were saying. Has anyone seen Ira Glass's thing on creativity? It's unbelievable, and what Jay Will just said reminds me of that. He says, when you first start, if you're a creative person, and when you first start out making things, there's a vast discrepancy between what you make and your actual taste, because your taste is actually quite advanced, and you really do know what's good and like what works and what moves people, and yet when you first start making something, it's so far from your own mark of what's good. And he says the challenge is to actually keep going in that first stage so you get to the point where you can express things at the level at which you imagine them to be good. And that's one thing that I do really, we should bring up Ben Zeitlin, the writer, director, and composer of this film, because for years he worked on shorts. And he always... for years and years and years. And he was always working towards getting what he was doing to be at the level that he wanted. And I think Beasts is the first time that it even comes close. So I would recommend going to watch the Ira Glass thing if you're at all interested in making stuff. And the lesson from it is that it can take a long time before you're able to express
an idea at the level at which you'll judge it to be good.
It's particularly true of, because Dan and I went to Wesleyan, where it's a similar, I think the way that Jay will describe Swarthmore, same deal at Wesleyan. I mean, we've had a film program for a while, but it's still a film studies program. You do spend a lot of time watching and thinking and writing about film, and so you do have that taste cultivated that Dan's talking about. So it makes it extra challenging to then go out and do your first thing. And a lot of senior thesis films are bad, at Wesleyan or anywhere, because we only took a semester of production. But I think it takes the perseverance to keep going and trying new stuff to realize like where you fit into the whole picture and what you're good at and what you want to keep doing.
Sure. The question was about how the film is influenced by things that are social issues that are affecting Southern Louisiana, and whether or not we hope that the film affects any social change. Is that a fair recap of the question?
I'd say actually no. I mean, it's very much, and it always has been Ben's prerogative to not make movies as a like polemic or as some sort of like work that will raise a fist at anybody and say it's your fault or this needs to change, blah blah blah. It's like, I think what makes Ben a good artist is that he's able to tell a story that can conjure a lot of these things that are from our time but also from all times, and make people find their own thing in watching the film that's specific to them, without getting too specific, because I think you can make a less powerful film if you get very, very specific about, you know, an issue, say.
I mean, I think that we each have our personal, I do hope that it affects social change.
Sure, although, but that being the purpose behind making the film. Is
yeah, but the question is, do we hope that it will?
Sure, yeah.
But I think in particular,
If
in particular, to me, the film addresses the question, like, when after Katrina, you heard from people on the outside, why don't you just leave? And I do think that after Sandy, we heard that too in New York, that like the Rockaways, like, why do you live here? And I think that the film's trying to make a case that where you come from matters, and that you fight for those values that place represents to you till your death. And I hope that the film challenges people's preconceptions of what a legitimate society is as well.
And I think Court 13 is, there are some discussions happening about the future of that as a production company taking on more or some of a social activist role. I know. So I'm in med school now. I'm very far away from the film world. But these are still the people that I care about. I'm still a Louisiana resident for some reason. Like, I can't leave it. And I would like to contribute in the future, maybe not necessarily to the filmmaking aspect, but if there's healthcare or educational, anything, sort of any kind of social outreach, I feel like that's kind of where I might loop back into the picture.
Well, yeah, I think along those lines, what Jay was referring to, I mean, we have discussed, you know, like kind of the hitting on the combination of arts and community and how you can make art and popular art as a community. And I think that's something that we're very interested in preserving in New Orleans, and creating a space for that. And that's extremely important to us. And what role that plays socially, I mean, sure, that serves some sort of function, to be able to have that space and do that. But that has always been of interest to us.
And regional filmmaking, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
That matters.
Going back to the scene with the mother, it's a little unclear. Did the mom recognize herself as a mom? And that's the preface to the next question, which is, why was it important for her to see her mom, to have that bonding moment with her mom before accepting her father's death and letting her go?
Well, I think your second question answers your first in a weird way, because actually that moment, it's not necessary. It's like very much up for interpretation or subject, you know, your subjective take on it, whether that or in fact that is her mom. But I think your second question, where you say, you know, why does she need to do that before she goes back? It's like the movie operates instead of kind of on plot, traditional plot logic. It operates on in a kind of emotional logic, and the emotional logic in that moment is that she needs some sort of maternal presence or force, be it a literal mother figure or a abstract mother figure, before she can realize that she has to go back and be with her father in his last moment. I'll say that.
Can I also say, I think a lot of the success of the film is more about that being, do I need a mom at that point? Like how, like the space that is left in the film to project yourself into. I think there are a lot of open ends on purpose, and that's part of the success of the film, if that makes sense. Like I think that's a powerful, that may be resonating with you right now because of how you, and all of us, you know, sorry to target you as a question, the person who asked, but me, because that's a really important scene for me, and I think it's an important scene for me because of how I interact with that figure, as opposed to literally what Hush Puppy, like what her literal relationship with her is supposed to be.
That's a question that in most all the Q&As that I've been in, people ask about. And people always kind of have their own opinion about it, and it's cool to see how that affects their you know, how they view the story and how they view the ending and all that stuff. So I think it's like, you know, really relatable to the viewer and you know, their opinion on it.
Because it may not be her mom.
Or it may be.
Quick question at the back.
You're holding acceptance speech written?
No. No, I think it will start with genuine shock.
Not to be pessimistic, but I don't think it'll start. Like I would be like, I will be extremely surprised. I will come back to Swarthmore and like run naked in mud if we win. Are you with me? You with me, J-Will?
J-Will, I feel like you would do that even without
any of the categories. Not to be pessimistic, but I mean, literally, this was so far beyond anything we were thinking about when we made the movie that the fact that we're going at all is like actually nuts. So,
Michael and I both have our outfits picked out, though.
Right, shrimp boots.
And I have to say, who are you wearing?
I think Brooks Brothers.
But I'm, you just said Hugo Boss.
Oh, Hugo Boss. Josh is wearing Brooks Brothers. Hugo Boss, because the Hugo Boss suits fit like thickly built dudes. This is what you learn on the awards campaign.
Yeah.
Well, we can't end on that.
Wait.
We can't.
I have one thing.
Someone must have
question. I have a thing. There's actually a fifth crew member in the room. Our transportation coordinator, Charlotte Juan Dean, is in the back. Please wave.
Hi, my.
Sure, as you
let's,
exit.
Let's do one more question.
Yeah, no, I just want to say there's a lot of you here, and we're happy to stay, but I want to say that we.
Oh, yeah, I always think in that point, it's like if people want to get up and leave, they should, but we are totally happy talking about it more, and we won't take it personally. It's Friday night. Time to get wild.
I like that they laughed at that idea. Yeah.
I used to go out on Friday nights here. I don't know what all this pessimism is
about. Oh, we have a question. Yeah.
Nice. Love your question.
Did everyone hear the question? I'll repeat it. The question was about what the title means to each of us individually, because it can have many different interpretations or meanings, right? Is that a good?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I don't want to start. I think the, well, I will start. I can't have the, for us internally, I think for the vast majority of the group, the word beast is meant as a positive. It's meant to imply a certain ferociousness, the strength, the perseverance, and sort of the catchphrase of the film is to beast it. And so what we like about the title is that it really does have many different meanings. And I think it's really playing with it's sort of, to me, it all leads up to that final confrontation between the two beasts of Hush Puppy and the Aurochs. And it's sort of recognizing in each other their strength, like letting them be. But I don't actually have an answer. I think it does apply to a lot of different things in the movie. But I will say that it is meant as a very positive thing.
Yeah, I think we actually started using the phrase Beast It even before we knew that the title of this film would be Beast of the Southern Wild. It's just like a phrase that we would use if you wanted to just like absolutely wreck like something you were eating. We would be like, Beast It, you know what I mean? Or do something to the extreme. But I think it also makes total sense given the kind of philosophy that that Ben is trying to explore in the film and that we're all trying to explore is sort of the idea of going through something really rough and just going for it, despite the fact that it's really rough and difficult and hard. And, just living in the bathtub, for example, despite the storms and everything, is a manner of beasting it. But it's also, to get at the beast of the Southern Wild, I mean, there's just a certain kind of fierceness and living despite everything that everybody in the film kind of embodies. And I think that's the spirit that we're trying to evoke with the title. That's what it means to me. But yeah, it all, and as well as where does that fit in with other actual animals that are not humans, you know, and how do they kind of reflect that as well?
I guess for me, it's a little bit like the term queer, where it's sort of like within the narrative, it's put on these people and then they are reappropriating it and using it as a term of empowerment and a way to define their community against what they see as sort of crude, inhuman behavior towards them, even though that term is supposed to be describing them as such. And I think, you know, in the meta-narrative of us making it and a lot of people, you know, reporting back to the world in 2009, 2010, when there wasn't much money or news and it was just sort of us being insane in the middle of nowhere, just sort of like, you know, we believe in this. This is real. It's true. Like, there's passion involved in it. We're beasting it. We don't really care what your outside sentiment is.
Something cool. I was in Nashville, Tennessee last week, and I screened it one day for a group for the Martha O'Brien Center, which is it's a housing development that houses homeless adults and tries to, you know, get them back on their feet. And at the end of it, the director came up after she'd seen the film and said, you know, like, this was a wonderful film. We're going to incorporate this into, you know, their lesson plan for the next week. And we're going to ask them, you know, like, what's the beast in your life? You know, and she was really emotional about it because, you know, she was saying, like, rarely do we see films that, you know, they understand as, you know, like, relatable to their life and the problems and the traumas that they face every day. And, you know, rarely do they see something inspiring in that sense. And, you know, and like Nazi or Hush Puppy, you know, taking on the beast. And that was really cool to me and kind of represented partially what the beast means to me.
Wow.
That's the porta potty.
Don't worry, that's safe.
We can have a reenactment.
Yeah, it's totally safe right now.
So many people just got up and left.
So let's make a more informal Q&A. I'm going to thank you again.
I love this.